From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a Republican effort to tighten up election laws in Michigan.
There is no case at all that's ever been documented of somebody showing up at a polling place and claiming to be somebody else. So again, this is a solution in search of a problem, and all it's going to do is discourage people from voting.
Also, the Michigan classrooms where teachers come, teachers go, and students miss out.
The problem that stems from this high rate of teacher turnover is that students in those schools learn to put up walls between themselves and their teachers because they have what I kind of consider educational abandonment issues.
Also, one East Lansing grocer checks in about the weirdest work here in living memory.
Slowly but surely, I think people began to realize that they didn't need to panic buy everything.
Those stories coming up today. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're going to dig into Michigan's problems with teacher turnover and how these issues have been compounded by the pandemic. That's on the way later in the hour, but first, Republican leaders in Michigan's legislature are moving on a package of election changes. They would require photo IDs for anyone trying to vote absentee. They'd also prevent the Secretary of State from mailing out absentee voter applications. And additionally, these bills would change some of the structure of Michigan's county boards of canvassers, which certify election results. The bill's Republican authors say that the changes are needed to tighten up the systems and ensure elections are fair. Here's State Senator Ed McBroom talking about it on WKAR's Off the Record.
There's real room for changes, amendments, reforms to our election law, some of which are directly going to impact voter integrity issues and maintain the security of our elections. Other ones that are going to help make sure process mistakes don't happen again that lead to people believing something fraudulent was going on.
But election experts and county clerks, many of whom are locally elected Republicans, have maintained that our elections are fair and were carried out with the highest levels of professionalism and accountability last November. Mark Brewer is a longtime election attorney and Democratic strategist. Mark, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Great to be with you again.
What are the central points of change that you see in these packages?
Well, I think you can draw a straight line from the lies that Trump told about the election, through the baseless lawsuits after the election, through those legislative hearings, which create a forum for all kinds of wild claims, none of which had any basis in fact, to these bills. They are in search of a problem. They are a solution to a problem that does not exist.
What do you find problematic about a photo ID requirement if someone wants to register to vote absentee?
Well, the photo ID requirement in these bills would apply not just to absentee voters, but across the board. So it's new in that regard. It applies to every voter, first of all. Second, there is just an enormous amount of evidence that the imposition of a photo ID requirement discriminates against the elderly, the poor, and minorities who have less access and less ability to get the kind of photo ID that is required here. We don't have a problem with voter impersonation in this state. There is no case at all that's ever been documented of somebody showing up at a polling place and claiming to be somebody else. So again, this is a solution in search of a problem, and all it's going to do is discourage people from voting.
Mark, I take your point, and there certainly has been a lot of misinformation about what happened in November. But admittedly, the state was in pretty uncharted territory last year. We have never had an election in which so many people could not vote in person for health reasons and public health reasons. There were millions more people voting absentee than have ever voted absentee before. And while clerks that we talked to said that, yes, it was definitely a big lift, they were able to do it, they did also acknowledge to us that our system is not set up in this present moment for such a large absentee vote, which isn't to say that it couldn't be tweaked to allow that. What's wrong with adjusting the system to make sure that absentee voters perhaps are verified locally, for example?
Certainly, improvements can be made, but this package doesn't make any of them. What local clerks need after, you know, they did a good job last year, led by Secretary Benson, the local clerks, a lot of groups. It was a very successful election from an absentee perspective as well as others. But what they need is not what's in this bill. This bill doesn't provide additional funding, for example. help those local clerks staff up to handle absentee ballots. It takes away the ability to provide prepaid postage to help voters vote. It puts enormous restriction on drop boxes, which were a huge help last year in terms of getting ballots back on time so they could be counted by 8 p.m. So yes, we could use help, better funding, et cetera, in our absentee voting process, but these bills go the opposite direction and handicap the absentee voting system. They don't help it.
Mark, is there any organized connection between the bills that have been introduced in Michigan and the ones that are in the works in other state governments? We've seen a lot of national reporting on what's happening in Georgia right now to change laws around voting. Is there any clone aspect to this?
You know, I think there is. Look, you know, we've seen a national effort ongoing to impose photo ID, to cut back on absentee balloting and other kinds of restrictions. So conceptually, these bills are exactly what we're seeing in other states. Now, they are customized to the Michigan situation, right? So we're seeing the customization there. But there's no question that this is part of a national effort by national groups and the Republican Party to suppress the vote based on the myths that President Trump and the Republicans have perpetuated about last year's elections.
I want to talk some more about this, but first, if we could, for a minute, discuss other methods of changing the rules. Ron Weiser, the co-chairman of Michigan's GOP, says that his party will collect signatures to put these changes on the ballot and then push it through the legislature that way. This could sidestep Governor Whitmer's ability to veto. Do you think that the GOP could collect enough signatures to make that happen?
Well, I think they're certainly going to try. That is a tried and true method here in Michigan that's been used by other groups to really instill minority rule. You think about it, we have a gerrymandered legislature, which doesn't represent the people of this state. And so a few hundred thousand voters can put a proposal to suppress the vote in this state and engage in massive race discrimination, and the legislature can adopt it without the normal checks and balances of the governor having a veto, et cetera. If they take that approach, I have no doubt that that petition drive will be challenged, as it should be, and this whole issue will end up in court, because much of what is in these bills and whatever they may put in such a ballot proposal will be unconstitutional.
Well, let's say that that does come to pass. How would you argue this case?
Well, I think there's so many different legal problems here. You start with, in 2018, the voters adopted a massive change in our election laws, no reason absentee voting. It worked very well last year. Many of the restrictions in this set of bills on absentee voting violate Proposal 2. Photo ID, as I indicated earlier, is a violation of equal protection. It's race discrimination. It's age discrimination. It's discrimination against people who lack income. So there are many, many different legal arguments that are going to be made if this were to become law and we're going to end up in court.
Ron Weiser's been in the headlines recently for threatening to burn Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, Governor Whitmer, and Attorney General Dana Nessel at the stake. You know, he referred to them as witches. Do you think the timing of that statement, for which he has apologized, do you think the timing of that statement might make any difference in the viability of what the party might try to do?
Well, it was a non-apology, first of all, but let's set that aside for the moment. All this package does, and all Ron Weiser's rhetoric does, is continue to raise the political temperature in this state, not lower it. The changes that are made here in terms of suppressing the vote, changing the structure of our elections in terms of what canvassing boards can do, they are all designed to continue to have controversy in future elections. We're going to have fights before canvassing boards. We're going to have fights in election places, not literal fights, but there's going to be many more disputes about eligibility of voters to vote based on alleged photo ID problems or allegations that a voter is voting fraudulently. This package opens the door to all of that. So what happened in 220 will not be an isolated incident. It'll become a regular occurrence in Michigan elections that there will be controversy before, during, and long after the election about the election results.
Going back to the point of the party's future, you know, under the current election rules, do you think there are avenues that could legally disenfranchise voters in Michigan?
Well, we certainly have seen attempts like that in the past. I mean, very aggressive challengers on Election Day, attempts to disenfranchise absentee voters. So, yes, there are existing ways that you can try to disenfranchise voters and abuses, and we've tried to deal with those over the course of time. This package of bills opens the door to a whole nother set of abuses and ways to suppress the vote that'll make our current problems pale by comparison.
You know, I just wanted to ask you one more question. It's a deep cut, but this package of bills proposes some changes to county boards of canvassers. And I think before the 2020 election, quite a few of us did not even know that there were elected county boards of canvassers out there, with a few exceptions. We saw what happened at a very crucial meeting of the Wayne County Board of Canvassers last year and the State Board of Canvassers. Do you think that the organ of having a board of canvassers to just basically certify election results, do you think that that is a piece of our election system that is still relevant?
Absolutely. And it worked very well until last year for several decades. It was installed after controversial recounts in the 1950s, where there were partisan local boards who controlled the election certification and recount process. So we went away from that and set up a bipartisan system where the parties watch each other. They serve as watchdogs over the local clerks and all the other election workers. And that system worked well. What I fear with this package, by expanding these boards and giving them more duties, we're going to open the door to the kind of obstruction we saw last year, that there'll be more county boards that will not certify elections and that will engage in the kind of obstructing tactics that were attempted last year. These boards have functioned very well for the last several decades because both parties took their responsibilities seriously, that they are watchdogs. They are not there to second guess local election officials. They're not there to insert partisan politics into the certification of elections. That's what we should get back to, but I fear these bills are a step in the opposite direction.
Attorney Mark Brewer. Mark, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
We've reached out to Senator McBroom to come on our show and talk about the election bills that he helped to craft. We'll have him on if you'd like to be a part of the conversation. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk through the proposed changes with John Peerich, an elections attorney who's represented several prominent Republicans, including President Trump, during a 2016 recount effort. We hope you can join us. Next up, we'll check in with a grocery store in East Lansing to talk about a year in pandemic panic buying. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In late March of last year, Michigan was going through its first surge of COVID-19 cases, and the whole state was getting its first taste of lockdown life. However, for several groups of workers, the world did not stop. In fact, it sped up. One such group was the unsung heroes of the pandemic, grocery store workers. At this time last year, we talked with Chris Faulkner, the manager of Food for Living, an employee-owned grocery store located in East Lansing. And Chris joins us once again 1 year later. Chris, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Can you believe it's been a year?
Yes and no. It both seems like forever and just yesterday.
Yeah. When we talked last year, one of the first things on your mind was concern for the health and safety of your employees. How are you and your folks doing?
Well, you know, partly by luck and partly by design, we're doing pretty well. We had no COVID outbreak in our store at all, so we feel very, very fortunate about that. We did have multiple challenges with people quarantining, especially early on when basically we didn't really know a whole lot about, you know, how contagious everything was and what to look out for and all of that. But we've fared remarkably well in that respect.
Have your employees been able to get vaccine doses?
Well, pretty much all of us now have one under our belt, and within the next 2 or 3 weeks, we should all be vaccinated.
One of the other things that I remember very clearly about the last time we talked is that you, like so many grocery stores across Michigan, were caught in this onslaught of shoppers. People were panic buying. People were buying more than they usually bought. People were buying different things than they usually bought. Did things ever return to something like normal?
I would say yes, although it's interesting. It was such a gradual thing as it shifted going through March, April, May. But slowly but surely, I think people began to realize that they didn't need to panic buy everything. But it was a gradual process, and everybody, I think, like we've noticed, everybody has their level of comfort, you know, and everybody adjusts to things at different rates. And I think that's what we saw in buying as well, with a few exceptions. You know, people were sort of obsessed with the toilet paper and the alcohol wipes and things like that. But in general, I do think probably by June things had returned to somewhat normal, although I would say a little bit elevated as far as purchasing quantities go.
Are there still things that it's difficult to keep in stock?
Well, yes, there are a lot of things, actually. Since I am in the produce, that's what I know best. And surprisingly, and much to the credit of the entire produce supply chain, we experienced very, very few outs, which is really stunning given the increased buying that basically everybody was doing. Groceries didn't fare quite so well, and supplements fared extremely poorly. We get like 25% of what we order. So, I couldn't say for any one thing how the supply is doing. It's all over the board.
I don't want to reduce this just to dollars, because I know that the accumulated stress of the year has been, to say the least, really something. But at the same time, we know that some of the bigger grocery chains are enjoying better than average profits this year. Since Food for Living is an employee-owned store, were the folks who work for the store able to benefit from the increase in shoppers and sales?
Yes, I would say so. I think we would have to ask them if it actually felt like it was a benefit. It's hard to define. As you say, the accumulative, you know, stress and level of attention to everything, it's hard to quantify that.
Right. I mean, I remember just hearing in your voice last time we spoke, just like your concern for the folks that you worked with and whether the store was going to be able to continue under these circumstances was very difficult.
Yeah.
In hindsight, what would you say are some of the toughest things that you've had to deal with this past year?
Well, I would say the continual awareness that everybody had a different view on the virus and its legitimacy, whether in fact it was real, whether in fact masks were a thing, you know, all of those things that I'm sure everybody are familiar with. We dealt with this on an hourly basis as far as what's going to happen next. Honestly, that was the primary stressor over the last year, is not knowing what to expect next from anything, really.
Well, what was the store's policy on masks and physical distancing? How did you decide to deal with that?
Well, we ended up what we call adaptive behavior, and I think I talked about this a year ago somewhat, is everything is always on the fly now, basically, and you have to make your best decisions with the best information you have at the moment. And so our adaptive behavior was continually adjust as you go, and what is working, what is not, when you encounter a person, and what is the best way of approaching it? How do you tell the person that, you know, there is a mandate on masks and that everyone needs to wear a mask in the store? And it's a continual engagement in terms of, you know, trying to produce the best outcome on those encounters.
Boy, that sounds like a negotiated response for sure.
It is. It's a learned response, and it's the fact that you have to understand that everybody's comfort level, everybody's belief level, everyone is at a different point. And no matter what you believe, if another person believes something different, that's something that you have to adapt and work with.
I think I'm hearing you say that at Food for Living, you couldn't just say masks are no service.
That's correct. You know, and we always shared our approaches and our successes and our failures. And, you know, make light of it. If somebody walks in, you go, whoa, wait, here, we have a mask for you, you know, lighthearted and you know, not saying you need a mask, masks are required. You know, there's a whole way of approaching it, and we quickly, seemingly quickly, discovered ways to sort of develop responses that got better outcomes.
Chris, the case rates in Michigan have really gone up over the past couple of weeks. They are, at this moment, higher than they were 1 year ago during lockdown. Are you and the staff becoming concerned again about conditions in the store?
Well, you know, that's interesting you mentioned that. I think most of us have read about that and know about it, but I think from a psychological perspective, we're not going there. We've developed a way of coping, to be honest with you, and we do what we need to do every day, and we're conscious of what we have to do to stay safe and be prepared and all those things. And so for myself personally, I don't allow myself to think about it a whole lot.
Right.
I just do what I need to do and watch my coworkers' backs, and that's what I focus on.
Chris, speaking as someone with a lot of gratitude for grocery stores, I really appreciate all the extra work. At the same time, as a home cook with a partner and a kid, once I feel safe about sitting down in a restaurant again, I might eat out for 3 weeks straight.
Yes, I think pretty much everybody feels the same way.
Right. Do you think that on the other end of this, there will be things about the business, delivery of groceries and curbside pickup of groceries, that might be permanently changed?
I think probably, but on the other hand, I'm also amazed at the inertia that systems have to keep things the way they are. And even though I've read a whole lot about, you know, things being permanently changed, and part of me believes that, and part of me believes that people's individual beliefs and preferences just continues to roll right on, irregardless of what what else is happening.
The outpouring of love and support for grocery workers early in the pandemic was really touching. That said, I do feel like, as everyone has been reminding themselves again and again to stick by restrictions and curbing their urge to be out in public, that, you know, people have gotten pretty exhausted with, you know, just the state of being at home all the time. Are there ways in which you've seen that manifesting in your customer base, or ways in which you've seen people kind of getting tired and getting worn out from all this?
Yes. I think there's a great desire, not only from us on this end, but from customers as a whole, to have things go back to normal. And no matter how much we wish that the virus wasn't here and that we wish things were normal, it isn't normal. And I think I see people's frustrations with that. And it, understandably, it comes out in things that they want to be normal, but that are not. And we try our best to be understanding of people's, you know, frustrations as well as our own. So I think, yeah, we try to let some things slide. I'll put it that way.
Did people's expectations change about what they hoped for from a store?
I think so. And I think going back to what you said about just the overall fatigue of just being alert and on guard with everything, I think that the expectations wanted to go back to a normal thing and normal expectations and normal just, you know, having everything when you want it and how you want it.
Chris Faulkner is a manager at Foods for Living in East Lansing. Chris, it's so great to hear from you. Thanks for talking to us.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Michigan and the rest of the United States is experiencing a big shortage of EMTs and paramedics. Recruiting medics is especially difficult in northern Michigan. Experts say that this is weakening the emergency medical system. Interlochen Public Radio's Taylor Wisner reports.
If you call for an ambulance in northern Michigan, chances are it will show up in just a few minutes. Of course, depending on how remote you are. But lately, behind the scenes, sending out ambulances has become a bit of a balancing act. If there's multiple emergencies at once, things get tense. Kent Adams is a paramedic in Benzie County.
Call 911. Everyone expects an ambulance is going to come. Well, they don't realize that, you know, we're at crisis right now.
The issue is there are simply not enough EMTs and paramedics entering the profession. The statewide association estimates there's more than 500 open EMT and paramedic positions in the state. Adams has been a paramedic for almost 30 years. It's been hard to find staff for a while, but he's never seen it so bad. Take, for example, Manistee County.
So we had 13 full-time paramedics that were there, plus our part-time staff, as well as our EMTs. Manistee, the last time I just talked to a medic a couple days ago, was working there, they have 4.
What that means is when an ambulance goes out, there's only one paramedic in it. 2 used to be common. That's allowed them to keep their response times respectable. According to Manistee 911, the average time it took for an ambulance to show up in March this year was about 9.5 minutes. 10 years ago, it was 7 minutes. Still, Mobile Medical Response's Jason McDonald says when your staff's so thinly, it's a problem.
You know, at some point, if we can't find the people or the people simply don't exist, coverage could be impacted. There's no question.
The industry agrees the number one thing hurting recruitment is pay. EMS makes money by billing insurance companies for hospital runs. But Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement rates haven't really increased in 20 years, and equipment costs have skyrocketed. That trickles down to salaries. According to Michigan Works, the average rate for both EMTs and paramedics in northern Michigan is about $15.50 an hour.
EMTs who've been doing this for 10 plus years were maxed out, making less money than what, you know, McDonald's and Burger King were advertising their willingness to hire people for.
To young people interested in the medical field, Adams is frank. He says, go to nursing school instead. It's roughly the same time in school, but almost double the starting salary. Across the system, Madden says it's become even harder to compete with hospitals. A recent incentive in the Affordable Care Act should make things worse. It offers federal money for paramedics to work in emergency departments, says Angela Madden, the executive director of the Michigan Association of Ambulance Services.
When you think about working in an emergency department versus working, you know, along the highway, in a truck, in an ambulance, I mean, the working conditions are dramatically different. The hospitals, thanks to that incentive from the ACA, can pay more. They have more regular hours.
Paramedics are burnt out. Because the pay is so low, it's common for people either to have another full-time job or take extra shifts at work. For most of his career, Adams has worked 96-hour weeks for EMS. He says it used to be a competitive field where you had to build a reputation to get a job with the crew you wanted.
And it's kind of gotten to a point because of the shortage. It's like, do you have a license and a pulse? Welcome aboard.
Another major issue is that northern Michigan is an EMS training desert. Right now, Munson Healthcare is the only place in northwest lower Michigan that offers courses. Adam says last year, they just had a paramedic certification, which educated already working EMTs.
You know, it was a net gain, nothing.
Angela Madden says in EMS, people typically want to work where they live.
You know, in more rural communities, you really have to recruit from within your community.
But to get started right now, you'd likely have to drive 2 or more hours for a class. Adams isn't hopeful that a fix for the structural problems will come anytime soon.
The only thing that they're going to do to improve this is they're going to pull medics out of Benzie County or Kalkaska or somebody else. All we're going to do is we're just going to shuffle the pieces on the board. We're not going to change anything.
Madden says right now her organization is lobbying the state hard for funding. They want an additional $10 million in the state budget for salaries and much-needed equipment, with an additional $5 million this year to jumpstart training programs. She says she's optimistic the legislators will hear their pleas.
They say nice things to us when we're in our meetings, right?
EMS workers aren't holding their breath. They say they're less visible to the public than firefighters and police officers, so they'll continue to be overlooked. That's until ambulances stop showing up. For Stateside, I'm Taylor Wisner.
Another class of workers going through catalytic changes during COVID? Michigan's teachers.
There are concerns. Teachers will leave the profession in large numbers once the pandemic is over.
Next up, a crisis of classroom turnover and what schools can do about it. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Picture this. You're a student trying really hard to succeed in school, get those grades, study hard. But every time you feel like you're getting a foothold, your favorite teacher leaves. That can be a huge blow to a student, both academically and emotionally. In Michigan, there are a lot of students who are dealing with this year in and year out of schools with high rates of teacher turnover. Chalkbeat Detroit reporter Kobe Levin has been digging into this issue, and he joins us now. Hey, Kobe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And also with us is Owen Bondano. He's an English language arts teacher at Oak Park Freshman Institute, and he's also the 2020 Michigan Teacher of the Year. Owen, it's really nice to have you back on the show.
Hi, it's nice to be back.
Kobe, tell us a little bit about what tipped you off to this issue. What made you want to dig in?
You know, if you talk to any teacher, especially in Detroit, you'll hear some level of frustration. And that goes back even before the pandemic, before folks were forced into teaching online. There's a lot of teachers out there who don't feel supported, who maybe feel that they didn't get adequate training or perhaps mentorship and support once they entered the classroom. And that's translated into problems all along what we call the teacher pipeline, from teachers coming into the profession in the first place, and all the way down to teachers leaving the profession once they've tried it out for a few years. So we knew that there were all kinds of problems. And the one that really stuck out because of the way it affects students is the phenomenon of teachers actually leaving classrooms at really high rates, making it hard for relationships and routines that are so important to school function to really set in and begin to work for students.
Yeah. How big of an issue would you say this is for Michigan overall? Do you know anything about how we compare with other states in terms of turnover?
Michigan historically has been above the national average for turnover. But when you really dig into the numbers, you see kind of a tale of two different states. In our sort of middle class and wealthier suburbs, the teaching workforce is actually pretty stable. They don't have a teaching shortage. They don't have trouble hiring for new positions. But when you go into our rural areas and especially cities, you'll see that administrators are just constantly beating the bushes, trying to find folks who are qualified and ready to teach. Kind of exacerbating the issue, teachers leave those schools at really, really high rates, rates that wouldn't be acceptable anywhere in the country.
Owen, the reason why we asked you to talk with us about this is that you've seen the issue from a couple of different vantage points. You used to be a sub, and then, to use the education term of art, a para-pro at a charter school. And you've also been a first-year teacher there. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've observed of teacher turnover in some of those various roles?
Yeah, all of those, you know, as a paraprofessional and as a first-year teacher, I was in a building where I don't know that we ever saw more than half of our teachers return from year to year. And it was a very common problem to have teachers leave in the middle of the school year. I remember as a substitute teacher, I would come into these various buildings, and I subbed all across both Wayne and Macomb counties, and I would walk into these classrooms where they hadn't had teachers for months because someone left in the middle of the year. And I used to, in all of my early 20s sort of optimism, I would think, like, how could these teachers leave these students in the middle of the year? How could they just, you know, even if I was in the worst situation imaginable, I couldn't imagine leaving kids in the middle of the year. And then in my first year of teaching, I left in March. I learned very quickly to have empathy for what was going on and for the fact that you have to do what you have to do to survive.
Well, what was happening that brought you to that decision?
The school where I started, I was not well supported. I was asked to do the kinds of things, the kinds of tasks as a teacher that, even looking back now with my experience, I can't believe they were asking a first-year teacher to wear all of those hats and try to accomplish all of those things with relatively little support. I didn't have any mentorship as a first-year teacher. And when things inevitably go wrong, because it's, as a first-year teacher, things go wrong in your classroom all the time, there was a general air of, well, if I was better at my job, then that wouldn't have happened.
Are we talking about discipline issues or academic issues?
Both. Sometimes it was discipline issues. It was often discipline issues in that school in general. One of the things that I think is a problem that stems from this high rate of teacher turnover is that students in those schools learn to put up walls between themselves and their teachers because they have what I kind of consider educational abandonment issues. And they don't want to form those relationships because they think you might leave at any time. And so it's really hard to build relationships with kids in those buildings. And so, of course, there's going to be disciplinary issues all the time. But I was also being asked to do the kinds of academic tasks where, like, I would wake up first thing in the morning, start work, go to work, work until the custodians kick me out, keep working on my couch at home until I passed out, and then, you know, wake up, rinse, repeat. I was so burned out that by November, I thought, I'm not meant to be a teacher if this is what teaching is.
Wow. Kobe, how does Owen's experience compare with what you heard for the story that you published?
You know, I think it's common. And what you got to think about it from a student's perspective. I mean, Owen is one of the most talented teachers in our entire state. And the conditions were such that he didn't feel he could stay. That was a huge opportunity for those students to have a teacher, you know, who, you know, had the chops, had the drive, wanted to make a difference for them. And it didn't work out. They ended up maybe having yet another sub or another teacher who had to try to, you know, win their trust. When we look at the research, and I talked to more than a dozen folks who've researched teacher turnover, one of the themes is that student learning, as measured by test scores, really suffers when there's a lot of turnover. Now, student learning is hurt even more when you're talking about students from low-income families. Yet in Michigan, those students are the most likely in the state to see their teachers leave.
Yeah, I've seen some increasing reporting, too, about teacher retirements during COVID and how the pandemic is starting to influence the issue. Kobe, what have you seen?
So retirements are up over this year. We collaborated on this story with Cranes Detroit, and Chad Livengood over there did some great work just to dig up the retirement numbers and talk to some teachers who just said, look, we didn't sign up for virtual instruction. Pandemic education has become too overwhelming. It's added on to the pressures that we faced and that were difficult to sustain even before the pandemic. And we've had enough, you know, so there's a good number of teachers, I think, if you talk to any district, who have used their right to retire and left the profession. Now, if you look at turnover, there's a little bit of a different story. Turnover during the pandemic declined a little bit. And as I dug into the issue, I learned that it's actually not uncommon, not surprising, for turnover in all professions, not just teaching, to decline during a recession because there are fewer other jobs available. But the researchers I spoke to said that based on all the indicators that they're seeing, all the signs of burnout, all of the feeling among teachers that they just don't feel supported, are not sure that they can continue. There are concerns among researchers that teachers will leave the profession in large numbers once the pandemic is over.
Well, no question. This feels like a cycle shaping up. There's a great burden on teachers who are in the schools right now. Teachers leave because of burnout, and then there's a scarcity of qualified staff and even more demands on the teachers who stay after that. Let's dig into what this means for students. I guess, Kobe, could we start with the academic component? Who are the kids who are most affected by this in the state?
Yeah, both our cities and rural areas see more turnover than is typical. I think those are for slightly different reasons. In rural schools, you've got to find a teacher who's willing to maybe to move to a small town, or maybe agree to a much longer commute than they might be looking for. So that's a challenge for them. And, in urban schools, there are other aspects of working conditions. And just in terms of the lack of support that those communities and those schools have had over time, that just make working in those schools much more difficult. Now, in both of those areas, you've got more low-income students than the average across the state. And yet research tells us, and there's been a lot of research into teacher turnover, that those same students from low-income families, are hurt the most when they lose teachers at school. They rely the most, to put it another way, on stability in their classrooms.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Chalkbeat Detroit reporter Kobe Levin. Also with us is Owen Bondano, English language arts teacher at Oak Park Freshman Institute, who's also the 2020 Michigan Teacher of the Year. Owen, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the emotional impact that you saw in the high rates of turnover, or thoughts you have about the academic consequences.
Oh, yeah. I mean, academically, it's easy to see why this would be such a detriment to students. You know, they start off the year with a highly qualified teacher, an expert in their subject matter, who at some point leaves, and then you have a long-term sub, if you're lucky, if it's not just a rotating daily sub in your room for who knows how long, maybe even the rest of the year. That would obviously be academically detrimental. We know how important a good teacher is to students' academic progress. And no amount of good plans given to a sub will replace a good teacher in that classroom. But emotionally, too, like I mentioned earlier, students have, in these settings, educational abandonment issues. They know that their teachers may leave at any point. And so they put up these walls. And it's my belief that the foundation of all good teaching is the relationship that you build in your classroom and with your students. And it becomes so much harder to build it when they know that you could leave at any time. And they're trying to sort of guard their own heart against you maybe leaving. And they don't want to get to know you. And they don't want to build a relationship with you because they don't want to lose it in the future.
Now you're at a job where things are a bit different, Owen. Clearly, you've received this award as Teacher of the Year. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about things that did make a difference and how they impacted what you were able to do in the classroom.
Yeah, I mean, I think once I left and I came to the school where I currently work, the sense of increased stability helps. You know, you feel like as a professional, you feel like you can begin to collaborate with the people around you in different ways, because you're not afraid that you're going to invest all this time and energy collaborating and then they're going to disappear. You can be reasonably assured that, you know, your students are going to be able to come back to you in the future. And that's a great benefit to where I am currently. I think one of the big differences, too, is that I'm now in a place that's unionized. There's a lot of things that I was asked to do before that led to my burnout that now my union would protect me from. And in that situation, it's not that I'm doing less for the kids. It's that I'm using my energy the most efficiently that I can for my kids. And I'm able to show up for them in a way every day that I couldn't before. I have that energy and I have that organization and planning. And I can sort of jump in with two feet when I'm in front of the kids in a way that I really couldn't before because I was so tired from all the other stuff that I was doing.
Kobe, when we talk about what school districts can do to keep teachers around, I'm not sure how much unionization is going to be something that superintendents would necessarily jump at. But what else do you hear about what districts can do to make it possible for teachers to stay longer?
Well, it is an interesting point with respect to charter schools. Owen taught at a charter school, and charters in Michigan don't tend to have teachers' unions. That's one of the things that charter school supporters like about charter schools. And by contrast, traditional schools are overwhelmingly unionized in Michigan. So, you know, if you'd look kind of at the reports, just the distinction between charter schools and traditional schools does jump out to folks, and unionization levels in those schools may be one reason that the teachers choose to leave or don't.
Well, but if I can just push back a little bit, it's not as if the school districts that do have unions are free from problems with turnover, are they?
No. If you look at the numbers statewide, you will see that turnover is clearly much lower in traditional schools compared to charter schools. And, you know, of course, there's a number of different possible conclusions that one could draw from that, including that unions are playing a role. You asked, though, about broader reasons or a longer list of reasons that turnover happens and things that we can do about it as a state. And there's really no shortage of options there, all the way from really small things to providing additional support to principals, so that they're able to build relationships with teachers and just offer basic supports that are likely to keep folks coming back, keep folks feeling invested in their school communities. Now, just as an example, I heard a story through my reporting of a principal in Detroit who was struggling with high turnover and just asked she reached out directly to teachers and said, "Hey, we're halfway through the year, will you stay? You're doing a good job. We really need you here." And she found that made a difference. Okay, so that's at the very micro level. Now, zooming way out, if you talk to experts, the folks who've worked on turnover, not to mention a lot of teachers, they will tell you that money is a problem, that there's just been a systematic disinvestment in schools. School funding adjusted for inflation has declined pretty sharply over the last couple of decades. And that funding pays for things like paraprofessionals, aides who support teachers, social workers, adults in schools who work with students, help meet their needs, and lessen the burden on teachers. A lot of teachers who I interviewed said that, you know, the whole burden of education is being placed on me. I'm being asked to do everything. And that's partly because schools more broadly, not just classrooms, haven't gotten enough support.
I'm wondering what the possibility is in Lansing to see some systematic help with this that might fix turnover issues in Michigan. We do know that the latest relevant COVID relief bill resulted in, $81 billion that the U.S. Department of Education released starting in late March. I mean, are you hearing anything, Kobe, about what the prospects are for the state legislature to make the kind of investment that would move the needle?
Well, I think regardless of what the state legislature does, schools are absolutely going to be getting a really substantial infusion of federal coronavirus aid. As you talk to educators now, their eyes are mostly pointed to Washington, not to Lansing, because there really is like a historic level of federal spending coming into schools over the next few years. In talking to folks about what could be done about turnover, I heard a lot of optimism that kind of federal funding can be used to jumpstart, just for example, teacher training and mentorship programs that would make teachers feel supported and better set them up to succeed in the classroom.
Kobe Levin is a reporter with Chalkbeat Detroit. We've also been talking with Owen Bondano, English language arts teacher at Oak Park Freshman Institute. He's also the 2020 Michigan Teacher of the Year. Owen, Kobe, it's great to hear from you both. Thanks for talking this through with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newen, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for touching base with us today. We'll see you tomorrow.